Hi, this is Jacqueline, and you are listening to Dark and Enlightened. Welcome back, people. I know, it's been so long, but I do have an episode for you. In fact, I have quite a few episodes lined up for you. Someone was very proactive, and I'm proud of me, and yay. If you are new to this, let me give you the little spiel. If you don't know what this podcast is about, here's what I do. I discuss topics that aren't... I can't read. That aren't maybe the most popular to talk about, maybe too uncomfortable for people to talk about, and I call these topics, air quotes, dark topics. You'll hear stories from myself or others about a dark topic, along with some open and honest conversation, and ideally you will leave a little more enlightened than you were before. I feel like it's been so long since I've done this, and it has been, obvi. I have a really great episode today, and I am super, super grateful to Leela for having this amazing conversation with me. I am doing something new with my podcast. I am dropping information in the episode details regarding if someone wants to submit a bio, any links, anything like that. I'm putting all of that information in the details so that way you can find that there instead of hearing me jaw and talk forever. Just to give, well, it's not necessarily a trigger warning because there isn't like super like gritty details or anything like that, but it is a discussion where we talk about PTSD, bipolar disorder, suicide ideations, and we just talk about a bunch of other shit. So I hope you enjoy this. And yeah, let me go ahead and take you to the episode. Okay, hold on. Please hold while I connect you. Beep. Hi, everyone. So I am here with Leela. And Leela, this is an exercise that I learned in a coaching training where everyone was going to introduce themselves, but you introduce yourself in the three ways that you want to be seen as. So for example, if I were to be like, hey, I'm Jacqueline, I'm a podcast host, I'm a dog mom, and I'm an advocate. I love McDonald's, whatever the fuck you want to say. Like, don't feel super pressure, but I find that that's a great like gateway to like opening up more conversation about things. So I don't even want to get into your full story yet. Let's go with that. And then we'll see where that goes.
Oh, man.
Putting you on the spot. Sorry.
Yeah. So I'm Leela. I'm an activist. Also a dog mom. My dog is Emma Goldman. She's a 14-year-old toy poodle. I'm sure you've seen pictures.
Yeah.
You know, I just want to say like, you know, I guess I'm an idealist. Maybe that's too activist being an idealist too. And pragmatic idealist.
But. Yeah.
But no, I live in reality.
Yeah.
You know, I want to do all this stuff of like, oh, you know, and I maybe I shouldn't say, but I'm also like a wannabe politician.
First of all, don't say wannabe politician, because to give some background on her, she ran for office this past term. And this is the part that I'm so interested about, because not only did you run for public office, but you ran for public office being open about your recovery. And that is the huge thing that I am so curious about, is already running for office is so irritating. Like, it seems like it's just a lot of like focus and attention on every little thing that you say. But I am so curious what your experience was like running for office and being open with that recovery piece.
So when I first met with the recruiting team, one of the discussions was, don't you think talking about, you know, being in recovery or having addiction will be a negative? Is it a vulnerability? Mm. And I was like, no, I feel it's a strength. And then I'm thinking, you know, because I'm a bitch. I'm like, yeah. You know, like bring that, you know, put that out there and like bring it, because I want the global recovery community to Montana, like bring it on, you know, like you really want to play with me on that.
Right.
And I think sometimes in politics, the authenticity, your weakness that we see in society is your authentic strength. right? Because, I mean, how many people get through addiction and like walk out the other side, whatever that means?
Yep.
And then run for office. And he's like, oh, I'm going to make this a platform. Yeah. And I'm going to run. Part of my district was very lower income. Mm-hmm. And Esther's was like very upper income. Mm. It was a very interesting district. And I would talk to everyone in that one section of my district. And they're like, oh my God, what do I do? Where do I go? How do I get help? Like, what do I do? And they're like, thank you so much. And it wasn't, I was like, there's not a lot of options. There's no detox in central Montana. Unless you're a veteran, then you can go to the VA hospital. Mm-hmm. And then if you, you know, there's Medicaid beds, but good luck getting on that wait list. Mm-hmm. They just increased the Medicaid beds anyway. But I had a lot of people who would come up to me through the campaign. They'd see me in the crowd or at events, and they would make a beeline and be like, thank you for talking about this, because my daughter, you know, died of alcohol use disorder 6 years ago, or, you know, like my son is struggling. I just got them into treatment, and like, this is amazing that you're doing this. Or I had dealt with it. I just celebrated 20 years. I'm so happy that you're doing this. I mean, like, I'm a, you know, people would just come up to me like, you know,
very secretive. Right.
And I'm like, right on. Everyone is affected in some way or another. And Montana leads the country in beer consumption.
Really?
Yeah. Like we have a little over a million people in Montana. Okay. And so the stats are like, 5 beers per person per day.
What?
Yeah. It's crazy. Wow. So just and we just legalized recreational marijuana here. Mm-hmm. That's supposed to, I mean, the funding is just completely different. I'm not going to go into that, but, mm-hmm. So they just proved, you know, in the city to build, you know, the county in our area could have, you know, dispensaries, but they couldn't have in the city, but they just approved that. So we'll see how that goes.
Really quick to go back, what were you running for?
I was running for the state house, and okay. I was running against a very, very powerful man, nice man, moderate in most ways, but had high name recognition. Like all the grocery stores was, when I was growing up, was named for his family.
Oh.
And I would run up like, they're like, who are you running against? And I would tell them, and they're like, oh, well, good for you. Wait.
Good luck.
Which meant bless your heart. You know?
Girl, that's cute. Have a good one.
Nice. And then already like I would run it as Democrat, and you know, Dems are like, oh no, he's a nice guy. And I'm like, okay, well, you're not gonna vote for me. You know?
Yeah.
You know, it's just like a sacrificial, but I mean, like, I feel really good about what I did and like who I was up against. And I just moved back home to Great Falls and like kind of moved. I closed on my house, mm-hmm. and then I ran bought a home, moved for office, moved, you know, like I moved back to my hometown, bought a house, ran for office.
You know, as most like people do.
This is not your...
And to back up, first of all, like that already seems really intimidating to run against someone who's like king of the castle and like known everywhere.
She's a chair of a very, like one of the biggest committees in Montana now. He's the chair.
So
what?
And that's what I'm curious about is what gave you the confidence to do that? Because a lot of fucking people would not have even run knowing, oh, this guy's so well known. This is that. Like, what was it about your desire to run that pushed you through that?
You know, because he's so well known and well respected and well liked, that I could have run the campaign I wanted to run. I could talk about the issues I wanted to talk about and not necessarily worry about what he was doing, because, you know, it wasn't like the anti this person campaign, right? Mm-hmm. It was like, I need to talk. I think these issues need to be brought forth. And this is kind of a long ball game, right? So this isn't this campaign, but I can hopefully get these issues out. Even if it's not running again, it's something, you know, nonprofits just getting more things involved. So, you know, that's kind of what, I mean, when I actually wanted to run in a different district, in the district that I grew up in. But that was already like 2 people were already running for that. So they encouraged me not to do mm-hmm. and run in a different. And I actually live like a block away from the in Montana, you don't have to live in your district. You just have to live in the county. Yeah.
Interesting.
You just have to live in the county. So I live like a block away from my district, but you know, like, so that's the one thing about Montana is like, you don't have to live in, you just have to live in the county, which is so weird. Cause when I first paid attention to politics in Montana, I was like, that's what? You don't live in your district? How is right. that possible? Like what? There's so many people who like, they live out.
Are the counties big there? Or do you guys have a bunch? Really?
Yeah, they're okay. huge. They're huge. Hmm. I mean, one of the counties in Montana is like bigger than New Jersey.
Really? Jesus. Well, I guess Montana is pretty huge thinking about it.
It's the fourth largest state in the country.
So what? Alaska?
Alaska, Texas, California, Montana.
And then Montana. No shit.
And then Arizona.
Oh, really? I didn't fucking know that.
No, I think it's New Mexico. Maybe it's New Mexico is fourth. New Mexico is five. And Arizona, it's up there. It, you know, Nevada, New Mexico, the Arizona whole, like, are like
west.
Yeah.
And how did you even like want to get into politics? Because obviously you didn't move back home.
Oh no,
and just like bought a house and then you just saw an ad in the paper.
So let's go back. So yeah, I served in the military. Okay, so I grew up in Montana as an Air Force brat. My parents are from Montana. My whole family, we're like seventh generation Montanans, like homesteaders. And I was like colonizers, let's just say that. We live on a lot of tribal land. This is like Great Falls, which is a lot of the central part of like all the Plains tribes kind of came through the Great Falls and, you know, traded and all this stuff. So this is central location of a lot of the Plains tribes. So just acknowledging, you know, this long-term historical significance of this area. Mm-hmm. So my dad was in the Air Force and moved around a lot. So I lived here and then as a young kid in Las Vegas.
Interesting.
Which was so much fun when I was there last year, house sitting for someone. And I'm like, what the fuck? It's like, I'm like, that was like the desert when I lived. Like, there's like areas of like, that's where the bodies were buried.
Yeah.
You know, during the mob era, you know.
Right.
And it's like a bougie area of town now. And, you know, where football stadium is. I mean, the baseball and the hockey stadium is now. It was weird. But, and then we moved after fifth grade to England. And I lived there from sixth grade till the middle of my junior year. I went to the Department of Defense school called Lake and Heath. And it was awesome. I just did lots of crazy stuff.
Wait, Department of Defense school? What is that? Is that like a...
So it's a military school, Department of Defense. It was called DOGS, and I don't think it's called that now. I think it's something else.
Okay.
But it's the people who are in the military, and they send their kids to their, like, American school in their Air Force
foreign
base.
Country. Okay. Yeah.
So I went to Lake Keith High School, and, like, it's crazy. See, like, talking to my, like, heathen... We call them heathens because the last name is, like, Heath. We're like, yeah. Heathens! And some people may not like that, but whatever. You know, like, and then I moved there middle of my junior year to Great Falls, my home, where I'm living now. And then my senior year, genius idea, decided to move me out to Fairfield, which is like 35 miles north northwest. It's about 500 people. Okay. It's like 80% Mormon. Mm-hmm. They've known each other since our grandparents were in the womb. It's not a place to move your kid your senior year. That's cruel. I mean, it's torture. I mean, not that anyone was rude, but no one was really nice. You know, they all
I was just going to say, was it already just like, we're a close-knit community, you're a new person, we're not going to bring you in?
Yeah. It just, there was like seven people who were like, not like the weirdos, like I fit in. I just got out of there as soon as I could and joined the
Army. How big was your graduating class?
24.
Jesus. So like, it's totally different. Like when someone has a graduating class, like mine was, I want to say like 500 people. Like, so if I never fit in, I was never popular or anything like that, but there's enough people to where it like isn't obvious, but in 24 people that's a little more obvious if you don't fit in.
I hated every day going to school because I was like that weird person who's like read everything. And I was like, what are you talking about? You know, and super into politics. So I am like the only liberal in the whole school, right? The only person, like, I was like Miss Political because I'm the only person who paid attention to politics. So, but I was always interested in politics. I was always interested in stuff. I mean, I was interested in, I wanted to be an astronaut because Challenger exploded when I was in third grade. And I told my teacher that I wanted to be an astronaut so I could blow up in the space shuttle and be famous.
I'm sorry, my dark humor fucking loves that. Like, here, imagine like you now as an adult, a fucking kid telling you, like, I want to do that so I can die and be.
because you're, oh, everyone's going to know the teacher's name. Maybe they don't know anyone else who was on the space shuttle. I mean, I know everyone because I like, I'm obsessed with the Challenger, you know, but like, you know, like bringing books to class, like fifth grade, they're like, I have to take that away from you. That's really highly inappropriate.
Wow.
And
it was,
and I'm like, why? You know, like, you know.
Okay. So this is also what bamboozles me is how, when you were younger, did you get into politics? Like, because
my
again,
granddad was big on union and like big in the, he's a carpenter and he's totally big on union. And I don't know how, but like in, I think it was like sixth or seventh. I don't know who and who like got me into, but I like, but like sixth or seven, I was like militantly opposed to the death penalty at like six. I don't know where that came from, but I was like, my issue. I'm like, I'm opposed to killing people.
So I just picture you like instead of a fucking lemonade stand, it's like you with a fucking petition, like, hey guys, let's oppose the death penalty. I'd be like, what the fuck is this kid doing?
I get my mom signed when I was like 10. There's like Sisters of Providence. They're like, it's like a petition that if you ever get murdered, your parents can't seek the death penalty. Totally out of my mom.
I love you're so morbid. Oh my God. I fucking love that.
I know. And so like sixth grade, the Dukakis Bush election was and Dukakis was against the death penalty. Mm-hmm. Of course, this holy Willie Horton and all this stuff. So I'm like, you have to vote for Dukakis against the death penalty, like at six, you know, sixth grade. I was like, I mean, I was in the military school at the time, like, Department of Defense school. I think I won like 37% of the vote in like the middle school because I was just going up and telling people, like, this is the reason, gotta do it. Cause, you know, I'm a baldy little sixth grader, right?
Uh-huh.
I would just go everyone in the playground because we had this mock election thing.
Uh-huh.
And I'm the only one supporting Dukakis because I don't know why, but people, because I asked, you know, and so it was always really kind of like, that was like my part, but, and I hated Reagan because like, I lived in Vegas when I was a kid and we had a lot of, you know, I like lived there from like 81 to 85.
Okay.
So I had a lot of older, you know, middle-aged gay men who were getting sick.
Mm-hmm.
About something they didn't know.
Yeah.
And I was watching these, my friends, who I called everyone uncle. I don't know if anyone else does that.
Oh, we do in the everyone's your aunt or uncle. Yeah,
yeah, I don't remember calling auntie, but always uncles, right? Okay. I don't remember calling people auntie, but everyone, all the males were always uncle, blah, 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 even though they weren't related. So we had a lot of friends, or I don't know how we somehow got connected with all this. And my parents are so homophobic. These men who were dying of something we didn't know about. Cause it's like 82, 83. Yeah. I mean, they didn't isolate HIV. There was like, they had some horrible names for this horrible disease and just pejorative, like horrible names.
Yeah.
So I was watching these people, you know, die, you know, through like 88. So I hated Reagan because he not talked about it. And it's like until like 86, it was like in passing. And it's like, I mean, it was only until Rock Hudson, his really good friend, you know, announced that he had AIDS and he was dying, but that was 85.
How old were you at that time?
So I was eight. They didn't even call it HIV until like 84 because they didn't isolate the virus. It's so late. I mean, this whole thing is just ridiculous. I can go on forever about this. So that's like thing I got. I like, didn't like Reagan because of HIV and AIDS and watching my friends, my parents' friends and just uncles just die. This horrible death, horrible, horrible death. Like early 80s, I mean, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, watching these people just, it's horrible. I can't, I mean, I'm still traumatized.
That's a lot, especially as a child, but then it's a lot, especially with like the stigma that's associated with what they're dying from. Cause it's different if it's like you're a kid and your grandpa or grandma dies of old age and like, yes, but like to see it playing out and for you to be so self-aware at the time of like, this isn't right that no one is helping. Like, that's huge.
Yeah. And we had people like staying in our houses and like in hospice beds and stuff like that because hospitals wouldn't take them or their family wouldn't take them.
Wow.
They had nowhere to go. And like, that's one of the things that's like my big, people don't talk about it, but like, I'm so like thousands of red ribbons, you know, I like wear them everywhere and people look at me and I'm like, you know, okay, you don't grow up in the 90s, did you?
Yeah.
Like, you know, I was wearing them like, what's that for? And I'm like, oh, how old are you? Mm-hmm. Like, maybe you don't have to realize it, but it's something that I obviously is very so around, and you know, meds are great and prep is awesome, but it's still, people are still dying.
Yeah. And will you describe what prep is to people if they
you can take it pre sex, so you don't get, if you are exposed, you won't seroconvert.
Okay.
And there is one, which is interesting. I'm not sure. I haven't looked, but there's one that's not for women. It's just for men. There's more. Mm-hmm. There's like five different types of prep, and you can get it on your insurance. Your insurance can give, can put it for you. So it's, if you see the advertise, it's fairly, it's still annoyingly really targeted to men, which it still pisses me off. Mm-hmm. I mean, just like the stereotype, because like, because that's statistically, I mean, I just think it needs to be clear.
Yep.
That it's not just men who contract it.
Exactly.
You know, and I have prep stickers on my leg, some water bottles, and I think people need to be aware of it. And that's one of the things, like, you know, maybe some Republican legislators will try to take away, because whatever. And then, so I got into the Army, and then I went to, after the military, which was, I don't want to talk, we can talk about a veteran. I served for a while. I try not, that's something that I don't spend a lot of time on, because it just was a horrible experience. And and I would tell people, if you're a woman, don't, because it's just not an environment that's healthy, and it's just structurally just not good. This is my opinion. I want to warn, like, everybody, like, this is what you're getting in there yourself into, and this is the step, this is the structure of it, and it's really not interested in changing, or I'm not sure if it's able to do that. So that's my, I mean, like, I have a lot of friends I still talk to that are like my lifelong friends, but like my experience in general is not as positive. So
how long did you end up spending in the military?
A little less than 4 years.
Okay.
And I do have some of my like Army stuff. Like I was in military intelligence on the wall. So after the Army, I went to University of Virginia, and I was a women's studies.
Weird. I'm so shocked.
My favorite part about being at UVA is I have this handbag, and there's this feminist like book called, and it's called Cunt. And I was carrying around just to watch people's facial expressions when they looked in my bag. And I'm like, what was wrong? They're like, Anyways, that was fun, especially like the frat boys were like, I. So I did a lot of activism, like living wage stuff. And I was on student council, and I got student council rep of the year once. And I was the chair of the committee as well. But then after school, so this is how I got involved in politics, like in campaign. I worked in politics in campaigns after. So I went to this march called Take Back the Night. It's like for violence against women at mostly universities. And in Charlottesville, they would walk from the downtown mall to UVA, which is like a mile and a half. That year, I was walking with this guy who was running for Congress in 2004. It was right after the invasion of Iraq. He was a two-tour Vietnam vet, like Green Beret, badass dude. And he was like, I was talking about women in the military and like women in combat arms. And he's like, well, no, we can't be there. And I'm like, dude, we're already there. We're just not getting the medals. So I walked with him and I talked to him about a bunch of stuff. And I was doing a lot of National Organization for Women stuff at the time. So he's like, hey, meet me for coffee at like 4:45 on Thursday. So I roll in like 4:15 because I'm neurotically early everywhere I go. You know, maybe it's the military, maybe it's just whatever, but I'm always rolling in like half an hour early, and I wait like an hour for people. So he came in at like 4:25 and he's like, how long have you been here? 7 minutes? He's like, yeah, no, we're not even talking. He's like, go to my campaign office and tell my campaign manager that I need a scheduler who understands my concept of time. So go. Later, I'm going to talk anymore. So I got this fell into this job as a scheduler for this congressional campaign. This guy's named Al Weed, badass guy. He's a venture now and supported my campaign for House. He gave me some money. I mean, I just randomly, I was like, okay, cool.
Yeah.
That's awesome. You know, unexpectedly and beautiful. So, and then I just started getting involved and worked in Kane's campaign. And then I did a lot of congressional races, mostly for veteran candidates running in like Republican districts. And I did that until 2014. So I graduated in 04 from UVA till 2014. And then kind of in the break between campaigns, I was working in a bar and I was drinking a lot. Not a lot. So I was working in a bar and I started hanging out with this person who I didn't really know that. Well, I mean, I knew he used, but I didn't know what he used. And started using opioids, like just literally went right to like the hardcore shit. So he was a kind of mean guy and I watched him, you know, shoot up and he went from like, I'm going to kill the whole fucking world to like the nicest person in the world. And I'm like, oh, if that does that for him and I'm high strung, you know, what it would do for me. And at that, when I did, I was like, I knew at that moment, that was the only thing I ever wanted. Wow. It was a God thing. I knew like, that was it. I will never do anything else the rest of my effing life.
Yeah.
Like, and then you're just chasing that for the rest of your life until you stop, right? In one way or another. Like you're going to die or you're going to stop using.
I love the way that you describe that though, because it's like, you saw this person who is clearly not a pleasant person. Then they take this and they're actually really quite pleasant. So it's like, I think a lot of times too, for people who have never experienced addiction like firsthand or haven't had family members or friends or anything like that, like, why would you do drugs? Why would you do something like that? If someone came up to you and was like, hey, I have this thing that I know you're already kind of like anxious and like high strung. What if I could chill you out really quick? It's like, I understand why someone would want to try that. And I think that's a big misconception, is that we always talk about like, you know, if we go the DARE model, like, oh, drugs are bad, blah, blah, blah. But in the same sense, like if you're trying to cope or seek something to help you cope, and you are presented with this, like, I can completely understand why you would want to continue using it.
It was, I mean, like I say, like, I was like, I'd only used for like 18 months, but then by the time, you know, like things changed with fentanyl, like it was like overnight with everything. And a lot of people were going out, they were dying. And I just, you know, I had a couple of people overdose in my house and we were able to bring them back, calling 911 and whatnot. So I called my mom and I'm like, dude, I'm not going to make it out. Cause I just not, I know, like I could see it. So I'm not going to make it out. So she came and picked me up and from Montana, drove me back to Montana. So I moved back here and I was living with my mom. So I was like 100 days clean.
Did you go to any sort of like detox facility?
No. Okay. So I did go to Mixion a couple of times cause I was trying to stop, but I would go there and I would stay like for 30 days. And I would go back to Charlotte cause Mixion's in Richmond. Like, I love John. John's the reason why I always say that John Schoenholzer is the reason why I'm back in Montana. Because I had a conversation. I went to a meeting and I was strung out. Anyway, so John came up to me and he was like, are you not from here? Are you? I'm like, no, I'm from Montana. He's like, why don't you the fuck get out of here and go home?
Yeah.
You know, I don't know. I don't know if you've met John, but I'm like, yes, sir. Yes, sir. Because I'm a military person and he's a Marine and he was like, just what the fuck, get the fuck out of here, you know, because John. And I'm like, okay, sir, that's fine, thank you very much. And then I call my mom. I'm like, John told me to call you, know. I just say, you know, John told me I had to leave, you know.
Wow.
And I was talking to John about it. He's like, I don't remember that conversation. I was like, probably not.
Yeah,
it was probably something so benign to you that you're probably just in passing, that just like probably ingest and like not, you know, because this thing's when you're just looking for something and you might say something to people, good, bad, ugly.
Yeah.
That you have no idea that it's nothing big and it's like, make, you know, it's like changes the world for people.
And just to go back to, so you were using opioids for 18 months. Were you also like using like alcohol?
No. So, because okay. I'm an intellectual. And so I thought, you know, like back in the day when people would die from heroin overdoses, were mixing alcohol, right? Because of the half-life of alcohol. So I'm like, well, I'm not going to die from that. So I'm just going to stop drinking.
So it's like this fucked up harm reduction where it's like, I'm only going to die if I have alcohol and this. So clearly if I take alcohol out, we'll be good.
Well, and I mean, like, I think at the time I didn't really know that that fentanyl was like, I mean,
as prevalent as it was going to be. Right.
Yeah. And then so not, I mean, like when fentanyl, all bets are off with every substance at this point, like it's laced in everything out here. People are dying from fentanyl overdose because they buy Xanax and they're laced with fentanyl.
Exactly.
And they're laced, and meth is prominent out here because it's rural, right? Mm-hmm. And so they're lacing the meth with fentanyl. So everything's going to be laced with fentanyl. Mm-hmm. No matter what. So it's not just opioids. Everything is laced with fentanyl at this point.
Exactly. You know?
So like, make sure you have test strips and Narcan, which test strips are illegal in Montana. So we're challenging that. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm on it. So that's why I stopped drinking completely. So I was like, so I moved back to Montana and then I went back to Virginia to a convention and I used on a Sunday night and I woke up 4 days later in a coma because I had used and I hadn't used for like 100 days and I got hit with the fentanyl and I went out and they were able to bring me back. I was gone for like 11 minutes, at least from what I know, about 11 minutes from when I went down and they, you know, threw me in the ER. Thank God.
Wow.
They did that. And, then I did the CPR. They broke my sternum, a couple ribs, and which is, they're like, yeah, they did CPR right.
But how did they like find you? Were you with people?
Well, so I was with some people and they had a car and they drove me to the ER and they just like threw me out the door and like took off running. Oh, I've not spoken to those people since then.
Good.
I mean, I'm grateful that they dropped me off instead of just let me die.
Yeah.
Which is what happens. So yeah, that's the great moment. And I woke up and I'm like, the fuck? Like, I don't remember using. I don't know. I know who I was with because people tell me and the person has told me, but other than just she sending me a message, like blah, blah, blah. I haven't spoke with them and I don't have any need to.
Yeah.
Cause I believe they're still using, I could be wrong. So then I moved back to Montana. I was in the hospital for like 2 weeks because I ended up getting a staph infection from all of the, you know, wire, the
Jesus.
You know, yeah. Which is fun. I'm like, so I'm back to Missoula and the meetings were there, were good. And I was there for like 5 years, but I was like 22 months in. I went to an inpatient PTSD from the military treatment. Mm-hmm. And, I got out of this facility and I was living in a transitional housing for veterans, sober living facility for vets. And I was hanging out in my room with this guy who just came out of the, you know, substance use wing. I was in the PTSD wing. And I said, just, you know, innocently, hey, do you know anyone in town that has heroin? And he says, and then I thought he was going to say, well, I'll make a call. He's like, actually, I do. I have some right here. And blah, blah, blah.
No.
And utensil. And by the time I used, I was like, oh, shit. I don't do that anymore.
Wow.
And I'm like, holy crap, like that. I mean, people would have been like, hey, I'm going to call someone. I'd be like, I'm not really interested.
Yeah.
But because, you know, like, so I used for like 2 days. And then I went back in the rooms. And I'm like, and that's, you know, 6 years. And it's the 10th. So it's 6 years and I have a calculator, clean time calculator. Yeah. 6 years and 3 months.
So when you left the PTSD wing, like how long were you there for? And was the shit that you went through there prompted you or triggered you to want to use?
So it was 8 weeks. And it's like, your therapist, you know, follow-up is in 2 weeks. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Like haven't talked about this ever, never, like secrets, like shh, no one else knows. And they're like, good luck.
good luck. See you in 2 weeks. Have a good one.
Yeah. And no follow-ups, no questions. Wow. Just like, have a good luck. And yeah, so I was just like, you know, like so raw and just not. I've been to the same program like twice after that. And that wasn't. The other ones, like I would get discharged on Wednesday and then like Friday morning, I'd be in my therapist's office. It was awful.
Wow.
Because I didn't have any skills. I mean, I had I had the 12 steps, but that's not a lot of coping skills. So like, I don't know what to do. So
they open up this fucking wound, like this Pandora's box of shit. And then like, all right, well, we'll talk more about this in 2 weeks. See you then. And then you're just left with all this stuff to like unpack. And at that point,
especially in a, you know, we're in a, you know, it's a confined unit, it's a closed unit. Mm-hmm. So you're in home by yourself with no like structure. You go from like, because I'm a structure person, I can flourish. So I have no like what time to get up, and I'm like, what am I doing with my life? You know, like it's like the transitional house is like living there before I went in, and then I hadn't been gone for like 8 weeks. People were like, and I got new people who moved in. I'm like, who are you? Mm-hmm. And the whole dynamic of that housing changed. A lot of people moved out and they got new leadership in, and it was just like, who the hell are you? And, you know, mm-hmm. and it was just very, very highly problematic. Mm. I mean, like I said, it didn't happen the other times. They were much more supportive. I was not able to communicate that I am in danger.
Yeah.
Leaving here.
Yeah.
I didn't have the words to do that. I didn't know I was in danger. I mean, I thought, oh, I'm a big bully. I can handle it myself. I didn't have the skills to do it.
Like, did you know before that, when you were admitted into that unit, that you had PTSD? Or like, had you been previously diagnosed?
You know, they diagnosed me like, I think I had like almost a year clean that first time.
Okay.
So I have only got the diagnosis for maybe 10 months or so, official diagnosis. Because I had the bipolar diagnosis, mm-hmm. and then they're like, oh, there's more to it than the bipolar. You know,
is the
like,
bipolar something you've had your whole life, or was that?
So I got diagnosed when I was in the Army. So I got just, that's one of the reasons I was discharged, just to the bipolar. Mm-hmm. So I got diagnosed at like 22, but a lot of it is exacerbated by the
your
PTSD.
Environment. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think just chemical imbalances can happen because I don't have family history of bipolar. So I think a lot of it was just like chemical change from the PTSD. And then like, it one of the manifestations of that chemical imbalance for me is the bipolar disorder.
Was it something that when you were diagnosed with bipolar, like, did it click and make sense for you, or did you fight it at first?
I clicked and make sense for me at first. But then I definitely fought it for a long, long time because I thought it was just a tool from the military just to keep me oppressed. Obviously, like I said, I don't have good experience. Yeah. I stayed medicated for the first 2 years when I got out, but then I felt better and I didn't need them anymore. But then I started drinking. So I just drank.
I found a new medication. Yeah.
Felt medicated that way. Yeah. But I wasn't like a blackout drunk. I was just like, a lot of it's just self-medication. Like I realized when, you know, I needed it to slow down, I would drink, and my bipolar comes out in mania. So mm-hmm. alcohol was, you know, obviously it helped slow mm-hmm. down, at least, you know, for a while.
How did the opioids affect it?
So I don't, you know, that's a good question. I think since opioids just numb everything, I'm not sure I even felt anything at all. I mean, I know coming off and getting clean that it, you know, everything was just exacerbated, like full flowed. I remember I got to Missoula and I had like, still had, I told about 100 days clean. I would start to spiral out. And I was like, I think I had 114 days clean. I was really working a program. I was like, I'm working this willingness program. And because I was told I can't use my mind and mood altering substances. And so I went to the VA, and I was supposed to get in like July, but somehow I got moved up to April because I kept calling. And I was so suicidal. I knew exactly what train I was going to jump in front of. I was so suicidal. I was like, I'm going to jump in front of this like 1222 change outside Bonner. And I'm like, I know what bus to get out there. So I got into the VA, and this NP, had, you know, he's a wounded vet. He had a huge scar from an IED and on his head. And so he's a big, he's talking to me and he's like, you're bipolar. You need to be medicated. And I was like, well, I blah, 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 something like that. And he's like, what I heard him say is, will you take these for 30 days? And if you still feel like it, you can jump in front of the train. That's not what he said, but that's what I heard.
Yeah.
And I said, okay, I will, because you look like you've been hit by a train. And he didn't flinch at all. Mm-hmm. He was like, I mean, like nothing. There was no. I saw him like 6 weeks later and I was feeling better because I, you know,
medication. Yeah.
And I came up to him and I was like, really sorry for that comment. It was really rude. And he was like, I don't know what you're talking about. Carry on. And he like smirked at me and I was like,
yeah,
thanks. I mean, fine, I will do it. Yeah. You know, because I was working a program of willingness, you know, yeah, in my program. And I felt, you know, it took me like 30 days to feel better.
Wow.
You know, to get even.
And the suicidal thoughts, did that come primarily with your bipolar? Well,
I think it's primarily with the bipolar. Mm-hmm. It's not so much with the PTSD. My PTSD amplifies in other like self-destructive ways. The suicidality comes with the bipolar. And it's super, only, I mean, when I'm super manic. I mean, I deal with suicide ideation, suicidality like all the time. I think more people deal with suicidal ideations more than anyone ever wants to talk about.
Wants to admit. You know? Absolutely.
Yeah, because I'm like, I mean, like sometimes I can't take walks because I'm like, I'm going to jump in front of that semi. Mm-hmm. And I mean, like, because that's my ideation. I'm going to jump in front of a fucking moving car, really fast car. And like, like sometimes if I'm feeling like best not be on busy roads, you know, because I might just do it. So,
I totally get that. Yeah. Before I was officially diagnosed with depression, it was one of those things where I did not care. Like I would hope someone would like veer into me in traffic, or I would hope like whatever fucking hit me, I don't care. Like it was like one of those things where it's like a really loud intrusive thought, like jump in front of the fucking car. Like, and I know like there's definitely dark humor around that where it's like you have these intrusive thoughts, but in the same sense, like if they keep repeating in your head, that really affects the way that you start to like view yourself and view like, why the fuck am I here? What's the fucking point of this? Yeah.
I always say like, I list on like at a level of 1 to 10, my ideations usually always like around a 4, like all the time. They're constantly there. And then like, there's like liver levels throughout, and I will reach out. I have no hesitation to reach out to my therapist or even like the helpline. That, you know, the crisis line, the vets crisis line, which is an amazing tool, and just the 988, either one of the vets portion or the anyone, they're great. And you don't have to be suicidal. You can just be in crisis. Like,
yeah,
somebody just walk you down from the ledge and hear a familiar voice or friendly voice, loving voice on the end of the phone. And then you're like,
I love that. I love that you've utilized that. And I love that you're speaking about this because, yes, you see all these advertisements for like 988 if you're in trouble, da, 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 da. But then it's like, as far as we have, and I air quotes this, people can't see this, as far as we have come in discussing mental health, there's still a stigma that's associated with it. You know what I mean? Like being in crisis may sound like very scary to people. Like you don't want to tell someone that you're experiencing this, but the fact that you have utilized that and it has worked for you, that's amazing. I love that.
Oh, the people on the phones are awesome. I have not actually not met, haven't so spoken to anyone that's not so loving and compassionate.
Good.
And like, and able to walk you off that ledge and like get you on level ground relatively quickly. Cause I mean, I can just express them like, you know, and they're like, okay, you know, here's some solutions. You know, if I need to go to the ER because my ideations are too crazy and I needed some safe zone. Like I've gone into the ER because my ideations are so high. I'm not suicidal, but my ideations are crazy that I need just a safe space. So a lot of times I'm on the ER and just like, I needed sleep because I'm manic and I haven't slept for 4 days. So I just need a kind of safe space to sleep. And a lot of people, I've been in ERs that they just let me sleep, you know, bad enough to admit to the ward, but clearly bad enough to be needed some supervision. It's temporary. And, you know,
one question I have about that is that when you go through the ER, and I always hear about this with like people in recovery, that, and maybe you haven't disclosed this when you have gone to the ER, but if you are in this situation where you need their assistance, is there discussion about your prior drug use? How do they treat that?
They ask you, do you use drugs or alcohol? And I'm like, no. And sometimes I say, you know, I'm sober, blah, blah, blah. And they're like, oh, and some of them are like, oh, that's the word that I know means you don't use like intentionally. So,
yes.
Mm-hmm. You know, and they're like, oh, how long? And I'm like, oh, I tell them, they're like, oh my God, that's great. And I've not experienced, I know I hear lots of people experience. I actually have not experienced that. I mean, they will test you. They'll do a, you know, they'll do a blood, make sure that you're actually true. That's actually true, that you're not on drugs, which, you know, I don't care. Like, do it. But I've not experienced that. Oh my God. Really? Mm-hmm. You know, they're like, oh, good for you. And not like, good for you. Bless your heart. But yeah. Like, oh, great. You know,
an actual great. Genuine compliment. Yeah.
Yeah. And so, especially if you use the word sober, they are like, oh, okay, what's like,
that's a key. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yep. And they know that's like an intentional non-use.
Yep.
Not that you just don't use. I've not experienced that, but I have heard horror stories that people have, and it's ridiculous that they do. And my primary, like, and my dentist, and everyone knows I'm in recovery, and I don't, I mean, if I have a surgery and I needed to use in a stopgap, then I have no hesitation to use medication as needed, you know, short lived, you know, I have no hesitation to that. I preferly not to use opioids, but like if I'm having like major back surgery, God forbid, and they need to give me, you know, during surgery, a fentanyl, like, you know, under supervision, I'm probably not going to say, nah, you know, because,
right.
But I'm going to talk, we're going to talk through it.
Yeah.
You know? And if, you know, like, I think if you need medication stopgap for stuff, then just use them accordingly. And that's, you know, especially coming out of surgery and that kind of stuff, or anxiety medication. I have an anxiety medication, and I know there's people who in like my abstinence program are like, oh my God, that's like using, I'm like, I don't abuse this stuff. Mm-hmm. And I use it very sparingly, but because of my management, if I can catch it, before it, I mean, if I can catch it, like when it gets a little bit above hypomanic before it gets to manic, I'm going to take a pill to slow things down.
So
I have absolutely no hesitation to do that.
One thing I'm so curious about, especially with bipolar disorder, because I'm not super, super familiar with it. But when you have these, and obviously I've seen what's portrayed in fucking movies and random bullshit. And when you are manic, what does that feel like for you versus like your normal baseline?
I always think it's like my brain is like, I mean, a lot of it's like ADD. I can explain it to like people understand like thought. But it's like, I just feel like I feel like my brain is on fire. Like it's just, there's so much stuff going on. It's like pulsating and not able to slow down, like no matter what. And then it gets like, if it gets too much, like I veer into paranoia. I veer into like more self-destruction, and then when I'm super manic, I have an auditory, which crosses the line into like schizo kind of affective when I'm super manic and I'm not thinking, an auditory emerges. And I've only experienced like, you know, half a dozen times, but it's scary shit.
Yeah.
You know,
so what happens in those instances?
I usually go to the hospital. Just to slow down and get, you know, I need to be in a safe space because clearly I'm not able to, I don't, my skills that I know to use are not working. And I just need to kind of, I probably haven't slept for 4 days because that's the other thing. I'm like, go, do. And sometimes the mania is good because like, oh, I can clean my house. I mean, until, you know, and I can get all this stuff done until it crosses that like third day. And you're like psychotic because you haven't slept, but you're still like, you know? And so that's when things kind of cross the line and then you get, you know, paranoid for me. And like, and they are coming for me. And
is it something that even with your medication, this is still something that can happen?
No, it doesn't happen for me with medication. But if I don't take my meds, that will happen within, like, if I, like, let's say today, if I stop taking my meds, today's Tuesday, by next Thursday, I would be in full psychosis.
Wow.
You know, like my bipolar is really, I'm a rapid cycler. So it just was like 3 days. If I miss my dose, if I don't take something for like, let's say I miss three doses in a row, I mean, I'm out for like another 5 days just to get recalibrated. Wow. So that's why I have alarms.
Yeah. Like,
because my meds are timed, they're time release. So I have a special time. I'm like an hour late for this one. So I'll just, you know, go back to normal with my other one. I have to be really, really, really cognizant of that time release. Mm-hmm. So, but the meds work. The Metamune works is amazing. It works for me. It keeps things at bay.
You kind of alluded to this and we kind of talked about this before we started recording, but the concept of taking medication that is mood altering, mind altering, does not necessarily make you sober, like that sort of aspect.
Oh, that drives me crazy. So that's why I said I came in at like 2006, the first time to the rooms. And I was told a lot by people that if you use psych medication because they're mind and mood altering, it's bullshit, that you're not clean. And I was like, oh, well, I want to be clean, so I won't take them. And I couldn't last more than like 100 days because I have a chemical imbalance and need medication. And I will yell at anyone who says that. I will flip my shit. That is complete. And there's literature on it. There's like in every 12-step program, there's literature about what that actually fucking means. Stop telling people to do that because people are going to kill themselves.
Yeah, exactly. It's like this desire to, I want to be sober. And then you have other people who are like, well, you're not really sober unless you're this. Like, how did that even make you feel?
Well, I mean, I think it was like, I wanted to do what was right because I want to be part of. And it's just like, I'm not good enough if I don't do this that I'm not allowed here if I do.
Yeah.
Oh my God. Yeah. Or, I mean, like it's blacklisted if you do. I mean, there are people who still like people who have been in certain fellowships a long time who feel that way. Mm-hmm. And I actually just stay away from those people.
Yeah.
Because our worldviews are different. I've been slowly pulling myself away from my 12-step program fellowship just because, you know, like I'm not finding my people, my like message, because I just puts people out. Like I want people not to die, but I'm not going to be like judged. I don't feel judgment. I'm like, I'm in this thing that abstinence makes, because that's what works for me today.
Yeah.
And it may not be forever. And if it doesn't, I'm not going to like, oh my gosh, I've decided not to be abstinent and just like do here, you know, harm reduction or something like that. I mean, that's not where I'm at today, but I don't feel start feeling guilty if I decided that, you know, my path has changed. It's no longer just strictly abstinence-based and I can do this. I mean, if I make that decision someday, I won't feel guilty about it, you know, because I think recovery is fluid and maturity and with therapy and with just, especially with medical care and all that stuff that you could do. I don't think it's good to be drinking while my bipolar. So that's why, and that's another reason why I wouldn't, because it's just not healthy for me. But I'm not going to judge myself if I decide to.
Right. You know? And I think that's the hard thing too, is that there's like these outside voices that start to weigh in a lot more.
Yeah.
And for you, like what finally made you feel comfortable with the idea that, or feel confident that I need to take this medicine? And if someone's going to call me not sober, like, fuck them. Like, what was it for?
I mean, because without it, I would want to, you know, like, end everything.
Yeah.
And I mean, I don't, right? You're like, you really want to. And then you're like, nah, I really don't. I just want to stop this craziness, right?
Yeah.
And so, like, so
it's
if
like
I can
ending
take
things for the wrong reason, like just to shut this. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So if medication and therapy, because you can't, I believe you have to do medication and therapy. You can't just do medication because it's just, it's a band-aid. It's a band-aid, but I mean, I would be taking something you know, forever. And I asked my, you know, this PharmD, PhD PharmD, like, hey, am I ever going to be able to not take medication? And he's like, no. And he's like, this is why. He's like, I'm not trying to bust your bubble. I'm not trying to make you feel bad. I'm not trying to be like judgmental. And he was like, he talked about like
the scientific of it.
Mm-hmm. And I'm like, okay, because I'm a dork. I like science. I like to know that stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. You know?
And that makes sense to me. And I'm like, he's like, but you might be on less meds down the road. And that's something we can aspire to. But just by believing that you're with your illness, that you will be without any meds. No.
Yeah.
I mean, he didn't beat around the bush. He's like, no.
But I love that, A, he was blunt about that. One thing that my brother, I remember him talking about this, is that there was a time that he was put on Suboxone. And I remember at that time when I didn't know what it was. And he was like, oh, it's just a short-term thing to help with the cravings and the withdrawal. Like, it's not something you only take it for a few days. But now understanding more the science behind it, and now understanding more that someone could be on Suboxone for the rest of their life, or whatever it may be, methadone, whatever it is. Mm-hmm. But taking away that stigma, because it's almost like when you hear, oh, I have to be on a medication for the rest of my life. If someone were to be like, I need to be on this heart medication for the rest of my life because I have a fucked up heart or whatever, then mm-hmm. people are like, oh, totally get that. But if you're like, oh, I'm going to take my antidepressant, or I'm going to take my whatever for the rest of my life, it's almost like there's this, people might think negatively about that. Like, do you find that you'll get sometimes that weird feedback?
Oh, yeah. I get it from like a lot of people in recovery, and also get it from like a lot of political, especially like in feminist circles, because of like the patriarchal medical establishment.
Yeah.
You know? And I'm like, I'm all about critiquing that, and like whether or not we are, you know, like what's the reason for it. But then I'm like, I know, you know, especially they're in COVID, they're like, you know, like you just have to get your microbiome like set, and you won't, you know, like viruses don't cause diseases. I saw that on this like page, and I'm like, what? I mean, huh? I mean, like literally this is a woman that I really liked her stuff. And I was like, block.
Yeah. Well, and like,
I'm not fucking with you anymore, lady. Nah.
But that's another thing too, is that like, I absolutely was someone who was very, I had my own stigma against medication. So like when I kind of had the vibe, like maybe this is not like grief, maybe it's more depression, I did seek out like a homeopathic doctor. Mm-hmm. And I thought, I can do this naturally. Like there's got to be a way. Mm-hmm. And I tried that for a fucking year, and mm-hmm. it didn't do anything for me. Mm-hmm. I had to move to medication. But when I told my homeopathic doctor, hey, just a heads up, because I was, and I don't know if you've ever seen a homeopathic doctor or whatever, but sometimes they make you do some weird shit, and you're taking like tinctures and shit, and they're like, you got to fucking counterclockwise turn things. I don't fucking know. But I was just like, whatever, I'm going to buy into this process. But when I told her, I messaged her and I said, hey, so this hasn't been working for me. I did see like a psych nurse, and I'm going to get on sertraline, which is the generic for Zoloft. And like, does this have any interaction with like any of the tinctures I'm taking from you? And she's like, I need you to call me immediately. And I was like, okay. So then I call her, and she's like, so you're going to go on Zoloft. And she was like, you know, that's poison, right? And instantly was going off about her experience with Zoloft. And when I took it, I was a zombie. I was this, I was that, blah, da, 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 da. Fucking pharmaceutical. Da, da. And trust me, pharmaceutical companies are bullshit. I will never. Yeah. But there are certain medications that do really, really well. And antidepressants, you know, bipolar medication, whatever it may be. She was so like stigmatizing in the way that she was like, well, I hope it works out for you, good luck, because like she was just so like salty about it. And I was like, you know what? Yeah. Fuck you, I'm never fucking talking to you. If someone's gonna shit on, I'm trying to get my head better, and it's not your way, like I'm just not about that. Like, who the fuck are you to say, oh no, like you're just gonna go further down, and I hope it doesn't destroy your brain. And I'm like, my brain's already pretty fucked, so I don't think we're on that path. But again, I totally get wanting to be like natural and like,
yeah,
and fuck, I mean, I fucking smoke weed every day. And so I get like plants. I'm all about that shit. But in the same sense, like some medicine is just really good and it works well. And I just can't even imagine, especially in your instance where it's truly like, if I don't take this, I want to fucking off myself. Mm-hmm. Like, why would you then question someone's, you know what I mean?
I mean, like a lot of times, like I want to be normal and not have to tell you and blah, blah, blah. But then you're just like, I'm not fucking normal. I'm better than that shit, you know? And I mean, like I'm on a med that's really, you can really fuck your body up. I'm on lithium, but it's a godsend. I'm like, I mean, I don't really give a shit what anyone ever fucking says about lithium. It is the only thing that works for me. It is a godsend. I mean, as long as I like make sure I'm hydrated and like, you know, like, that's it. Make sure I'm hydrated and I'm not like, I can't get dehydrated because then I would get sick. But, and it's been around for a long time. It's got like 50 years of research. Like,
and there are, and again, lithium is something too, where I know people have tried it and it wasn't the right thing for them. And I think that's the other thing too, with like any sort of mental health thing, you have to try different shit to see what will work. Like, did you immediately start with lithium or did you try other medications?
And then I tried lithium at first when I first got out of the army, and then they gave me a whole bunch of stuff because a lot of people don't like it. They like, there's so many side effects, blah, blah, blah. I get it. Like, not my current psychiatrist, but the one before, I was like, dude, none of this stuff works. You have me on like 6 medication. I'm like, you know, like, because nothing's working, right? And I'm taking a whole bunch of meds and I'm just not getting the thing. So I want to go on lithium. And she's like, cool. Put on lithium within 3 weeks, baseline.
Wow.
Like, I'm on a really good, they actually just lowered my dose because I was, you know, knocking on doors a lot. I got a little dehydrated and I got toxic on it. So they lowered my dose and it's taking me a while to get recalibrated to it. Mm-hmm. But I swear by lithium, it's like a godsend. It's one drug that works for me no matter what.
Why is the dehydration a big deal? Like, what ends up
because it's a heavy metal. And so it metabolizes through your kidneys.
That filtration.
You need to keep your fluids up. So I'm always drinking water and like, I was out on the doors in hot weather and just wasn't drinking as much as normally I would, but just because it was so hot and I was doing so much, I just needed to, you know, like another like 36 ounces of water or 32, and it would have been just fine, but Camelback.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. You know, and just make sure that I drank all of that. Mm-hmm. So, and you just have to be, you know, your blood draws to make sure your levels are and make sure your kidneys are okay. And I have no problem with that. I love the drug. Awesome. I swear by it. And nothing else has worked.
Yeah. And it's like, if you find a solution for you that works, then great. Like, why would anyone shit on that? And that's the one thing I can't understand, or to kind of like go back to the recovery community in general. If there are people listening who are like, what the fuck's the recovery community or whatever it may be, but it's like, it's really comprised of people who obviously no longer use substances, or maybe they utilize harm reduction, or maybe it is family members, or maybe it's whatever the fuck it is. But what I have found in this community, not only have I found like a lot of really great, I found you, but like a lot of great uplifting people, but you definitely also have those people that are very judgmental if you do not recover the way that you do. And when you have these conversations with those people, like for you, like what helps you with your recovery and staying in that? Because I know you had mentioned that you're kind of like pulling back from your chapter and kind of recognizing that that's no longer helping you in the way that it may have used to be. So like for people, say, for example, if someone is listening, they have been like all about 12 step. But they're maybe in like that situation kind of like you, where it's like, this isn't like serving me in the way that it used to. Like, what were some things that kind of like triggered you to think maybe I could try something else?
Oh, well, I went to a meeting once and this is my last in-person meeting here in my town. And, you know, because I'm running super Republican area. Mm-hmm. And I got, they're like, oh, you don't really belong here because you're a fucking communist.
Wow. Are you fucking kidding?
No. And I was like, okay. I'm like, y'all are not my people. And, you know, like, and it was like in conversation after the meeting, and it was like these, you know, good old boys who you know, like, oh, because I had my, you know, my signs on my car, you know, like,
yeah.
Magnetic signs. And they're like, yeah, communist. And I'm like, for me, that's like the worst thing they could ever say to someone, right? Mm. That's like the most insultive thing that that person could ever say. And so the person who said, and all of them, no one defended. No one was like, well, no, chill out, dude. No one said, you know, no one said that. I was like, and so I just do a lot of online meetings, which are great, but like the energy, I mean, like, want to be around people who are like, who want to do badass shit. And like, yeah. I see, like, I got into recovery and I believe that like my understanding of the program that I want to work is like, you learn how to live, you learn these spiritual principles, you learn how to like function in society and be a productive member of society. And then you go out and do that shit. Right. Yeah. And you kind of like maintain some connection to your recovery community, but this is not your life. Like you need to like build on what we give you here. And like spread the wealth, right? Mm-hmm. And like give back and like be of service. And that's, and a lot of people just think that be of service is just to the fellowship of this 12-step program right now. I'm like, I don't think that. Like I'm thinking I'm gonna use my foundational knowledge, relearn foundational knowledge here, and then you know, the spiritual principles that we learn here, which are amazing, and like just the way we communicate people and like how I did things and like, you know, like if I open a meeting, like I have a commitment and I have like, I follow through that and my word is honest and I like do all this stuff. And then I go out and not like, I'm not like, you know, sliding slogans and like quoting texts and like in public, but you, the way you live, because you learn this stuff, you can vibe. Like when I meet people, I know people who are in the program by just talking to them. Yeah. Like, even if I don't know that they're in the program, a certain 12-step program, because of the way they cover and the way that if they work, especially if they like are they're working, the
verbiage,
it's also just the way they act towards people, right? It's just like a vibe. And maybe I'm wrong some of the time, but a lot of times I'm like, oh, that's why I knew that about you, but I respect people's anonymity because if they work that. I mean, if they come out to me, then that's cool, but I'm not going to out them kind of thing.
Yeah.
So, but I don't care. I say I work a 12-step program. I don't say which one because that's not what you're supposed to do. People ask me, and I'm like, it doesn't matter.
And with those, again, for people listening who may not be super familiar with, oh, there's more than just AA, like what other programs?
I mean, there's NA, there's CA, there's like OA, there's ACA. There's a lot of anonymous programs. There's like, you know, like Al-Anon, there's Nar-Anon, there's all these anonymous 12-step programs that there's like, you know, like I think there's Meth Anonymous. Or, I mean, there's a lot. Heroin Anonymous. And then I don't even know there's a harm reduction, but I know there's a lot of stuff with, you know, Mara. These, you know,
yeah, I recently just heard about that. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. There's a medical, I don't know what it means.
It's like a medical assisted recovery.
Yeah.
Something. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so people who, because like, that's a lot, I mean, you come in and they're like, oh, you're on a methadone or Suboxone and you're not clean.
Right.
You know, like, because like, especially they're coming right out of treatment and then they're like, oh, I come here and they give you Suboxone. Most of the time they don't give you methadone anymore in treatment. They give you Suboxone.
Mm-hmm.
And then they get all this thing like, well, if you use that maintenance, I like that maintenance drugs, you're not like, you can use here, but don't claim clean time. It's like,
that's bullshit. That's such bullshit.
I mean, this is a medication, you know, like, and they're like, well, I don't belong here. And then they go out and they stop using the medication and they pick up something else and they die.
Yeah.
Like,
and it's like at this point, especially with fentanyl being, like you said, in everything for people who are listening, because I was talking, I don't know who the fuck I was. Someone who's not as involved, like, in the space that we're in. And they were talking about, well, you know, there's fentanyl out there. And I was like, well, fentanyl's in everything. And they're like, well, I mean, like, it's in heroin. I was like, no. It's in everything now. And they were so shocked. I'm like, if you use cocaine, if you use meth, like, it is laced in that. Because we have people who are stimulant users in our harm reduction org. And they have brought it up. Like, obviously they tell us about it, but what I find fascinating is that in this time of fentanyl and the, you know, scare tactics of the one pill can kill and all that bullshit,
it's, you touch it, you'll die. Drives me crazy.
like I'm just,
no.
I wish I also, like, did video. That'd be too much, like, effort for me to do, but our faces, you should have just the horror on our faces. But
it was ridiculous. It,
in this time of fentanyl, the fact that we aren't just pushing the idea, like, what's going to keep someone alive? Like, why are we even sitting here and going, oh, Suboxone's not clean? Why are we going to shame that fucking person? You know what I mean? Like,
it's like, do you want them to die or do you want mm-hmm. them to recover? And, like, mm-hmm. what does recovery mean? Like, I'm like, recovery means anything. I have, you know, I have friends who, like, you know, they smoke pot and they are in recovery. And I'm like, you're in recovery. Or they drink once in a while. I'm like, you're not doing something that maybe brought you into the rooms or, like, hit the bottom.
Yeah.
And I'm hoping that if it got out of control, they would be willing to be like, ooh.
Yeah.
You know, because they know that kind of, like,
they can check themselves.
Coming. You know, mm-hmm. it's like, maybe I'm drinking a little too much. Maybe I'm smoking too much, you know, like, or maybe that I'm craving something else now. And so now I need to kind of step back. Yeah, right.
Exactly.
And so you're aware. And, like, I think people who's kind of started absence, I mean, like, I've known people who start absence and they're all, and then they were like, this is what's going to help me. And it does. And they're successful.
Yeah.
And they're not killing themselves. Their life's not unmanageable.
Yeah.
Or, you know, and hopefully if it ever became, they could listen to the people and I'd also pull themselves back.
Yeah.
I mean, that's my hope. For me, absence works for me today. Mm-hmm. And like I said, I don't know if it will work for me down the road or if I really want to be part of this. You know, that's what works for me, but I'm not judging if you're not. Like, yeah. I'm not, if you're harm reduction, I mean, I became master naloxone trainer. So I'm like, you know, here's this, like, fentanyl test with all this stuff, like, you know, yeah. needle exchange, like, our sheriff will, like, refuse any needle exchange. Like, oh, it's just going to encourage people to use. Mm,
yeah, I totally
get it. And
the
fact that I have HIV, you know, like, and mm-hmm. Hep C, like, just, like, in my bones, like, wanting to, like, make sure we don't do this. Like, there's a lot of ramifications for this.
Obviously, we've been talking for a bit, but what I have found so refreshing is that for someone who ran for office, like, you're just so authentic and so, like, genuine, because, like, you hear fucking, and I am going to call you a politician, so I know you said wannabe, but fuck that. So as I feel like so many of us just want authenticity at this point. And when you were running for office, and obviously you had to have come in contact with other political candidates just outside of your own district, mm-hmm. how was that for them to see you be so open and authentic?
I got the same thing that you had, like, you, this is awesome that you're, I wish more people could be like that, and or that I wish I could be a little bit more that, and I'm like, do it.
What because stops what, them I like think, what do you think what stops them?
I think it's just, you know, this, I don't know, fear.
Yeah.
I think it's also, like, politically gray. I hate that term, but, like, I think some people just don't really, they feel that they don't want to hear that because it might offend them. And I'm like, but everyone deals with stuff, right? Mm-hmm. They just, you know, like, and I can say, like, this is from an authentic place, right? And I'm not, like, people talk about recovery, they talk about something like this. They might not be coming from a authentic place, so they couldn't do it. Right.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, like, I think that's what gives me, like, I've been, you know, I've served, I grew up, like, you know, very poor. I didn't realize how poor we were until I went to Vegas last year, and we went to the neighborhood that I lived in Vegas. I would drive by the elementary school, looked like a jail because
really?
It was in the, like, in a rundown part of town. Mm-hmm. It was barbed wire, like, full barbed wire, one door in, one door out,
wow.
like, on dirt roads, like. And then I went to the old, I was like, oh my gosh, there was still there was still tagging and stuff all around the playground. Not obviously not the same tags, but like I lived in a trailer court, right? Mm-hmm. And not that every trailer court's low income, but, and then I went to this park, which I thought was this is amazing park. I had this old memory of this like rolling hills. And then I didn't realize that it was a landfill that they covered over.
No shit.
And the playground playground was the same in like 1983 and they hadn't updated it. It was like halfway falling apart. And I'm like, oh my God. At that point, I'm like, I knew we didn't have money.
Was that like jarring for you? That's like really.
Yeah, it was so jarring. I knew we didn't have money, but I didn't know that we were poor. Yeah. Right? I had one pair of shoes like for the school year. Like, but I just thought that was kind of like normal because that's what it was for me. Right? Mm. I mean, maybe I had two, but just I know we like didn't have a lot of food. Mm-hmm. I mean, like the food we was processed and like hamburger hamper, we lived on that
cheap.
Crap.
Yep. It's cheaper. You know? Yep. Absolutely.
And sometimes not even with the hamburger because we couldn't afford it. Mm-hmm. You know?
Yeah. Absolutely. You know, like, helper. Yeah. I mean,
I remember those days.
Stroganoff. Yeah.
And like, you know, no fresh vegetables, no fresh fruit because that's just too much like canned stuff. Yeah. Just processed crap.
Yeah.
You know, unless you grew it, then you had fresh, you know, for that like 2 weeks that it was fresh. Yeah. I just didn't know that I was.
That's wild.
I didn't know that I was poor. Not knowing you have money and not knowing you're poor. And then like where my family lives in this, they still live in the trailers my grandparents lived in. And I'm like, I go there and it's traumatic. I'm like, oh my God. I'm like, I bought like a $300,000 condo.
Wow, that's amazing.
Actually, you know, and I don't have a new car yet. I will soon, you know, the next couple of years, I hadn't driven for a while because I didn't have a license. I had fines and stuff from active addiction. And then I lived in Missoula and I didn't need a car because there's free buses everywhere. So I didn't need one. I mean, I wanted one, but I didn't need one, right? So now I have a car and I'm like, whoa, I can go places. I mean, like I have a car. I have a
your
home.
Own place. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I mean, that I own. I don't care. Like people like the bank loans. Like, fuck you, I own it.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Like, my name's on the fucking title. Mm-hmm. So like, I hate that shit. It's a three level. I paid less than my mortgage than I did my rent in Missoula. So the, you know, three bedroom, mm-hmm. three level condo, beautiful.
Well, rent is insane now, like just everywhere. And I feel so bad for people. Like we, thankfully, like we bought our house 2017. Mm-hmm. And we've been able to refinance twice.
Wow.
When we got our house, it was one of those things where it's like, it was to stimulate the economy, you know, like, oh, people aren't buying shit. So here's this government program where we'll grant you like some percentage as like your down payment. And in exchange, you're going to have to like take this fucking class online. You have to have a certain income, certain credit score, certain debt to credit ratio.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And then you're going to get a higher interest rate. And so when we bought our house, the interest rate at the time was like 5.25 or something like that. Mm-hmm. And people were like losing their minds, like, oh, that's so high. And I'm like, well, can't I just refinance when it goes down? And so like when the pandemic it was the following year and our dude was like, hey, did you want to like refinance? Because rates are low. I was like, okay. And so we did that. Like I had no clue this was even an option. And then during the pandemic, he called again. He was like, hey, rates are even lower. Like we're waiving any sort of appraisal, we're waiving all this shit.
Wow.
And so we dropped our interest rate down to like 2.9% and took 10 years off our mortgage because it's like, I think sometimes people don't know of these things and it's like they get so caught up like, oh, interest rates are too high, I can't buy. Well, you could also like later on switch that up and change that up if you need to. It's insane how high rent is. And like you said, our mortgage is cheaper than rent is anywhere. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And that's including the expensive insurance. It's just like the rent is like includes the insurance.
Exactly.
It's and like, oh shit.
That's funny. Insane. But yeah, no, I think that's such a jarring thing though to think about. Like you have these memories of your childhood And then you get like, it's a totally like different picture. Isn't that wild? Oh,
it's funny because I'm like, I'm in a nicer part of town. I live in the north side. I would never have thought owning a house. But I had the VA loan. I don't know. It's crazy. And I'm like, I own a house.
Now, did you think you wouldn't own a house because of your upbringing, addiction?
I think it was upbringing. Like, and I think like, I didn't know whether or not I really wanted to have a stable house because we moved around so much. And then I like in college, then I did campaigns. And then I'm like, you know, in and out of like, you know, homeless shelters and like transition house, my own apartment, like apartment living. If you have PTSD and some of your things are noise, don't move into an apartment complex.
Yes.
And they should like, cause I was coming out and then I got a section. I was, you know, until I got my VA coverage that kicked me off of it, but cause I'm making a lot of money now, but I Section 8, you know, and they put me into apartment complex. They should be like, oh, you have PTSD and you're like, what even is noise? Maybe you shouldn't live in an apartment complex because it's never going to be good. Because just a normal noise is going to be too noisy, right? Mm. And so, like, people can do just daily activities, and I'm like, you know, slamming cupboards, and I'm thinking, all I hear is boom, 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 boom.
Yeah,
you know, like, door with slamming doors, and just like just normal daily activities was too extreme, especially if you were living in an apartment building with like 20 other apartments.
Thin walls. Yeah, exactly.
Walls are thin, doors are thin. And they should be like, oh, you have PTSD and bipolar. Maybe you should, mostly the PTSD would be this thing because noise is a big thing. Yeah, maybe you shouldn't live there. Like they should give you some accommodation. Like, by the way, this is a bad idea.
Yeah.
Because like, just
it's
even
just
if
setting
it's,
you up to fail.
Yeah. And so I got like, I got kicked out of my, so what happened was I lost my Section 8 voucher because I made too much money, which is fine. That's awesome. High class problems. Cause I got all my VA coverage back. I got 100% from the VA and I qualified for school social security. Cause you know, I just applied for it. And since I got 100% VA, you know, so there you go, which is great. But, so good high class problems. And so they didn't renew my lease. They gave me like a 30 days, you know, month to month. And it was like Thanksgiving. And there was an army guy below me. And it was like Thanksgiving Day. And he was just playing his music really loud. And I could hear every single note. I knew exactly what song lived on the third floor. Mm-hmm. So I went down and I was like, can you just turn it down a little bit? And he's like, wow, I can do whatever the fuck I want. Blah, blah. And I'm like, okay, then thank you. You know, and I was like, you know, I said, I could be a bitch if I wanted to, because I live above you, but I won't. So
Great, starts stomping around.
Of the property manager and said I threatened him.
Oh, come the fuck on, dude.
So they gave me they said, you know, you're going to be out.
Wow.
I think they were just trying to move me because they probably didn't know. Maybe they didn't know I made the money and I got kicked off the voucher. They thought maybe I kicked off the voucher for probably some nefarious reasons, not because I made too much money. Because they don't tell you. They just said this voucher is ending.
So they may have already had their own bias and like, okay, we need to get.
Yeah. I think like if you're on a voucher and you lose a voucher, something must have happened and it must have been like you suck, that you got kicked off of it because you did something wrong that now you're loaded.
Yeah.
You know?
Right.
So, and I mean, like, just worked out. So then I was kind of homeless. And one of my friends had a condo down in Vegas. And he's like, I'm in Mexico for, you know, 6 months, 8 months. And like, you can stay in my house. And I'm like, okay. So that worked. And then I got back from Vegas and I decided to go back into the inpatient at the Fort. And then at that time I was, one of my good friends, he's a realtor, and he's like, are you ready to buy? And I was like, yeah. I was looking at Butte or Great Falls, and my family were like, you better move back to Great Falls, fucker. Mm-hmm. You know, and I'm like,
and when was something. This?
That was last November. Well, September. And so I found this place the very last day I was looking. I'm like, if I can't find something here in Great Falls, then I'm just going to look at Butte from now on. So I found this condo, and I made an offer. And they accepted it that night.
That's awesome.
I was like, it took like 40 days to close. You know, because it's so much crap. It's like appraisal, blah, 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 blah. You know, underwriting, all this stuff. I mean, there's so much stuff that goes into it. And there's like 40 different like aspects of like, here's your like your bank, your lender, your yes. underwriter, your blah, 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 you know, all this crap.
46 people involved who need like, your fucking blood test and like, they need everything.
I had no idea that this was like the way it worked.
It's like, am I applying for the FBI? What the fuck is this?
I mean, they like so much stuff like, yeah, but I mean, it was fine. It's just like getting all the information to them. But the people who had this house were absolutely filthy. I mean, there was like mm-hmm. this much dog hair and they left so much stuff behind. It took me like 2 weeks to clean everything to get.
Did they just dip out on their.
You know, I don't really know the details, but I know that they were like shoving shit in cars the morning because I closed. Oh. I had my paperwork closed at 9 o'clock and I came back at 11 or a little bit after that to get the key. So they were still probably shoving shit out that morning.
Wow.
They left so much stuff here. Mm-hmm. I mean, I was like, okay, wow. Like that big dog. I mean, like.
And then of course you're like, okay, now I'm settled. Let's run for office.
So I was going to run. I was at this treatment and one of the guys in my group was a politician in the area. Okay, I love everyone. I love everyone. Mm-hmm. There's no one I hate, but I hate that fucker. I'm gonna run against
him. I love everyone, but I hate that fucker.
I'm gonna run against him, but then there's two people running against him. Mm. So that's how I decided to run for the who I ran against. Mm. I hate that guy. He gave this big spiel about people who are in recovery. Shouldn't get any kudos for doing the right thing because they just shouldn't ever use drugs. And we should never give people accolades for doing the right thing.
Wow. So it's like he almost sees it as like, why should we give credit to people who changed their life like when they should have just been doing it right the whole time? Like that's...
Yeah. Yeah. I've never heard anyone say this before. I mean, there was a lot of other things, but that was the thing. And I was like, I mean, like, it was like the instant like...
Yeah,
I'm going to fight. I mean, like, I'm not going to punch you. I'm going to fight you. Like, we're going to fight. And then therefore, I'm going to fight all of y'all. Yeah. Like, everyone who does shit like this. Like, and I'm here to fight.
And I think that's something that's really, I'm not going to say overlooked, but maybe it's just not talked about. It's like, when you have these representatives in your area, and they say this stuff out loud, like, the weight of what you say has such a big impact. So like someone may have just been like even keel on the situation. You know what I mean? Like they could have just been like, whatever, use drugs, don't use drugs. But then if you hear someone make a statement like boldly like this, then that might make you think like, oh, someone else thinks like this, but it's like such fucked up logic. And then it just leads to like this ridiculous, like you can have your opinion on things. Obviously, we all have our own opinion on things, but to just make a statement based on, and I'm sure it's personal bullshit or whatever, you know, whatever it may be, personal stigma, like to say something like that and just the amount of people that would affect, like that doesn't sit well. That
he just, I mean, there's a lot of things else he did, but that was like the major jarring point. And I mean, it just got worse and worse and worse. Time, but I was like, yeah, I think there's a lot of reasons for that. Our paper is gone now. Like we don't have a newspaper. It's like bought by, you know, whatever. And it's just AP. There's no local news on it.
Really?
So it's awful. And there's other newspapers in the state, but none of them cover Great Falls so much. So the vacuum is, you know, right-wing radio, Fox News. So I can go knock on people's door. I don't call a terrorist on the door.
You've been called a terrorist?
Somebody called me a terrorist on the door. He was an older guy, probably mid-70s. I'm a politician. So my first impulse, and I'm also just a bitch, so was I asked him, where did he serve? And he said, no, I didn't serve. And I wanted to say, what waiver did you get to get out of Vietnam, motherfucker? But I didn't. So I said, let me tell you about my military experience. And I just calmly talked to him. And the guy was like, oh, I'm so sorry, ma'am. So sorry, ma'am.
Wow.
I'm so sorry. Thanks for your service, ma'am. I said, do me a favor. Don't ever call someone a terrorist again.
Yeah.
He's like, I'm so sorry, ma'am. But I mean, obviously, if I would have started yelling about what waiver he got on, it wouldn't have been good.
Yeah.
But when I dealt with him, I was like, let me tell you about mine. And he's like, you know, I didn't know how to react. And so I think, you know, running in a very Republican area as a Democrat, we need to be able to be like, push back against all that stuff. Because I think what has happened is that we are like, in this, at least here, what I've seen is that people will say something that we believe the Democrats, blah, blah, blah. And we don't be like, nah, we don't think that. And we don't say something in opposition. We don't like fight back. And then we're silenced. And then so many people are like, well, they didn't say anything. It must be true. Right. Because you didn't say anything. Right. The silence is deafening. Silence equals truth.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
So if somebody says something, this is why I love a lot of the stuff that's coming out in recovery, like especially the fentanyl. Oh my God, they touched fentanyl, they died. Yeah. And there's like, nah, fucker, it doesn't happen like that.
Yeah.
And there's like a lot of people are just like pushing back. I'm like, no, no, no. You push back and they're like, oh yeah, you're right, you're right, you're right.
Yeah.
So, but if you don't push back, they're just going to keep on pushing.
Mm-hmm.
So I said, that's what I did on the doors. Somebody would say something to me and I'm like, let me tell you about this. Let me actually, let me clarify. Let me tell you. And I'd be like, this is my position. I mean, regardless of what I think about Joe Biden or Nancy Pelosi, they're not helping me.
Yeah.
I don't know them. Mm-hmm. I'm running on this. And this is the issue that I'm running on. And I'm running as me. I'm not running because I'm anti so-and-so and I'm not running anti-Trump. And I'm not running pro Biden. I'm running this like I'm the candidate.
This is me. Yeah.
And take it or leave it.
And I hate that that's really how things have become so black and white. And things are very, and I think that really obviously started like 2020 was just like a fucking lit everything on fire. But like, I think a big piece was like, I have friends who are Democrats. I have friends who are Republicans. I have friends who are independent. I personally am independent. Like, I lean more left, but in the same sense, like, I'm not going to stop being friends with someone if I automatically hear, oh, you're a Republican or you're a Democrat. Like, that is not going to be the qualifier as to whether or not I'm going to, like, have you in my life. But if I can have conversations, and I think like what you did is amazing to be like, oh, well, let me educate. Like, education is so fucking key. And like, there are times when both sides of the aisle can come together on something, but it should really happen much more often, because it's like, now it's like red or blue and it's like, you know.
Yeah.
And I hate that. And it's like you said, like, oh, they hear you're a Democrat, so automatically you're associated with everything. And it's like, that's not necessarily true.
Right.
And when, what I was going to say in regards to that is, would you, if there are people who are interested in running for politics, and there are, especially now, I think a lot of people are realizing we need to fucking get in there and like have a wider range of opinions. What advice would you have for those people who are looking to get into politics or just even run for something, but like even just like to mentally prepare for? Because like, sure, I'm sure you could go to whoever and be like, hi, I want to fucking run, blah, blah, blah. But
no, I think you just need to be like, so what I said, if you want to run for politics, this is the first thing to do is like, what do you say about yourself? Mm-hmm. And what are they going to say about you?
Mm.
And if you can handle what they're going to say about you, then go for it.
Yeah.
And like, and that's good, bad, and ugly. They can be like, oh my God, she's in a substance user. Blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
You know, like if you can handle that, like, or something like that, just those are the things, like if you can handle that, good, bad, and ugly. And then I'll say, like, just don't be afraid to be like authentic, because everyone struggles. Like, I always say, like, when I ran in campaigns, I'm like, when I talk to candidates, I'm like, what are your skeletons? Like, have you done this? Have you done this? And like, we're going to get it out on, you know, word of mouth. We're not going to put a billboard up or something, but we want to get that out that people know that you have whatever struggle. Mm-hmm. Then we don't, everyone thinks that you're human. Like you haven't paid taxes, or like you've had a bankruptcy, or like you've had affairs, or you've done, like, you know, like in other areas, you've done drugs. Oh my God.
Yeah.
You know, that's kind of stuff. And like, and just, you know, like, I think the reason why, at least in Montana, the people liked Trump is because he spoke his mind. Mm-hmm. And he said what he thought. Mm-hmm. And they're like, that's badass. Mm-hmm. And people were like, I don't really agree with what he says, but I like that he says it. You know,
it's almost like that authenticity factor that a lot of people would think, depending on what side you're on, that is extremely abrasive and pompous or whatever. But to these people, that is their authentic. So they think, oh, finally, someone's not being politically correct. Because I will, I will fucking say, I hate it when you hear these interviews and everyone's so politically correct and won't address or give a straight answer or won't.
Yeah, they're like pivot.
Yes, exactly. You know? So after years of everybody pivoting, I can understand why he appealed to people, because guess what? This guy doesn't fucking pivot and he just says shit. So I get it. And again, this is me seeing both ends of it. And I think that's the tough thing, is that there aren't enough people, like, either in office or whatever it may be, that are willing to see both ends of it. And
And that's what we're doing now. So, my people who want to build coalitions.
Yeah.
Are like saying, like, so we formed a nonprofit. It's called Independence Rock Coalition. You'll see some stuff on my Facebook and all this stuff coming up. We're doing a recovery advocacy day. We're actually also throwing a zombie ball on Valentine's Day in a chapel in like an old Catholic hospital.
Dude, that's awesome. Fucking cool.
And but so like I'm thinking, like, how are you building coalitions? Like, listen, I mean, this is how I feel about things at this point, and not at this point, but every point. There's a couple of lines in the sand that I'm not going to cross. Like, I'm not going to be like friends with, you know, Holocaust deniers.
Yeah.
Or like serving something. Like, there's people that I wouldn't try to find an interconnection point at all.
Yeah.
But there's a lot of people who I'm like, I don't agree with you on 80% of the stuff you're talking about. But then that 20%, we can see, like, how are we going to build from this? Like, especially in recovery communities or anything with healthcare. Or anything with education or with HIV, you know, anything like that, stuff that I care about. Even if they're like opposite in me in some other ways, we agree. So these, if we can find these intersection points and connect things that are like, I feel those are like-minded or like-minded groups for maybe that issue, maybe not everything else. And so we can be like, I disagree with you on a lot of other things, but I don't hate you. As a person, you know, like, I don't dislike you. I can disagree with you. I think you want to do what's best for the community, and we might not have a different idea of how to get there. But we want to get there. And so that's the thing that I want to talk about. So I've spoken a lot of within recovery community. Like, I've had a lot of Republican legislators reach out to me and said, like, I'm so happy that you ran on that, you know, like, hopefully you'll stay involved. I had, you know, outside of Democrat, I've had Republicans people do that.
That's amazing.
And, you know, like, elected officials. And so this is not this should not be a partisan issue. These certain things like that affect so many people do not need to be partisan, do not need to be polarized. Absolutely. And I hope that my job in this community and like in the world is to find those people to intersection points and build that like-minded thing, even if we disagree on how much stuff. Like, it's like massive Venn diagram, right? We can just be like, here we go. And so there's groups that I don't really want to be affiliated with, and I will be like, nah, but there's not many.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. It's just more so like these extreme ends of. Yeah, I totally get it. Like, I feel like we're very much on the same level where it's like, I'm absolutely willing to listen to someone if they have shit that it's like based in logic and not purely from like your own bias or stigma or whatever. And I'm willing to see another side of something. But I think now it's so many people have just, they don't even want to listen. Like, they don't even want to hear that other side. And so, like, we need more people to run for office, and we need more people to be able to listen to the other side and not just be like, I'm team blue, you know, like,
no, and yeah, I can be like, I'm super progressive on a lot of issues, but that's why I said I'm a practical real idealist. Like, I'm super progressive, super idealistic. And I have a vision, but I'm like, I'm also pragmatic about how we get there.
Yeah.
Like, how would we have to join forces? And I don't think I don't necessarily think of working with people who might disagree with you on certain things or against your integrity or against authenticity. Like, I just want to get things done. And I want to have like things, not people not dying.
Yes.
And, like, you know, like I would say, like, I want people to stop dying.
Yeah.
Or unnecessarily. Mm-hmm. And like, and this should not be a no brainer. If I can work with people whom I disagree with you on certain other things. And I would say, like we have a sheriff who's very, I don't know very many people in like progressive circles that like him. And I've talked to him and I've known him for a long time. And I disagree with him on a lot of stuff. There might be some, I don't agree with him on hardly anything. But I know that I could come to talk to him and he would be open. He would be open to communication. You know, like I know that there are some things that he would be willing to work on even.
Yeah.
And so I can disagree with him on a lot of stuff, but I know he's approachable and I know he's level-handed. And it's also how I approached him. Like, I don't approach him. Oh my God. Hey. You know, like I might disagree with you and I don't have to.
Yeah.
I mean, Patton says, I always love this quote. If two people are thinking like, then no one is thinking.
Yeah. That's true.
And I think it's funny as a general quoting that, but
like
military guy.
Yeah, exactly.
But he was, you know, a little bit of a different type of general.
Yeah.
His whole thing. But I like that completely. And when I think about it, I'm like, yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah.
Patton.
So now that you've done this and now that you have run, like what are your plans for the future or what are you focusing on now?
I just want to build this, to start this nonprofits as building coalitions and just start keep talking about what I was talking about on the trail. Because I think is so what happens when people lose and they lose like heavily, like I did, they disappear.
Mm.
And they're like a voice that's so important and so amazing. And they are embarrassed or they're angry or just disappointed. And I'm like, I knew what I was getting myself into, like who I was running against and the likelihood of winning was not high.
Yeah.
And so I went in a different kind of way. I talked about stuff I wanted to talk about. I did some data analysis because I'm a data person on targets, you know, as we can move forward. I kind of just played around with the race as much as I, you know, because I knew what was could be the end.
Yeah.
You know, and I feel really good. I think that my voice and the voice of the people that I've brought to the table and that have like stirred some interest are powerful. And I'm just going to keep on moving forward in that community in the state. So it's like, I'm not going anywhere. And I think more people will come out.
Yeah.
Because I think that a lot of people have a really good story to tell. Mm-hmm. And they shouldn't be afraid to tell it because it's not this paradigm of like goody goody shoot, you know, no faults or blah blah blah. Like that's everyone struggles, you know. And then when we have elected officials who are so like out of touch with that struggle,
yes,
we need to eliminate that. I mean, like, you know, like the AOCs of the world, like working as a bartender to like, I mean, these are like stories that are amazing, you know, how you just walk through challenges and get through the other side. And I think in mental health, you know, substance use, anything like that, like those are badass, but anything through any challenges, no matter what it is, and get through the other side and want to give back, let's bring it.
Yeah. So. I love that. I think that's a perfect spot to end. Because just like, that's like your ending campaign speech.
Thanks very much.
Yeah.
I'm really looking forward to sharing, to seeing what it comes out, how
absolutely. And hold on, let me stop recording so everyone's like, well, I don't want to hear the fucking logistics. Hold on. All right, you are back with me, present Jacqueline. I think it was a really great way to kick off the year. I wish I fucking lived in Montana so I could go to the zombie ball, and if I had a private jet, I would just fucking fly out there, but flights are expensive and I can't go. But if you live in the area, you should totally go to zombie ball. All right, so still doing every 2 weeks. That's my cadence. The next episode will be dropping the 17th. So yeah, keep an eye out for that. Subscribe to me. I think you can subscribe or follow on like the various platforms now. That's how long I've been out of the game. But if you like this and you liked this sort of conversation, this is just what I fucking do. So subscribe, follow, whatever it may be. And yeah, that's all I got. Okay. Bye.